It's said that revenge is some form of wild justice. Saturday night in Montreal. Time to party with good friends. Sunday morning in Toronto. Not the thriving city center, but the remnants of the old industrial section. Not a place you want to end up.
At approximately 6:45 that morning, I received information through our radio room that a body had been found in the rear address of a factory in the east end of Toronto.
Who is this clean-cut man? And how did he end up dead in this deserted parking lot? In true crime, investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere in the first 72 hours. June 6th, 7 a.m. Detective Terry Wark arrives at the scene.
When we located him, he was lying with his eyes wide open. And there was obvious signs of blood on his body and on his left pant leg. Other than that, there was no other physical injury that we could see.
No weapon is found. On the body, no ID. Nothing but a distinctive silver pendant and a phone card. Police traced three calls made on it, one to a home in Montreal.
We left a message that whoever answered this message to contact the Toronto Police Service and ask to speak with us.
The only other evidence in the parking lot is a set of distinctive tire marks.
There was a noticeable tire print leading up to his left shoe, over his shoe, and then continued.
The tire print is unusual. Too wide for a car, not wide enough for a truck. The next morning, the autopsy report comes in.
He had a major injury to the spinal cord, at the base of the neck, and another major injury was to the left side of his head. There was a large stab wound there that pierced his skull and into his brain.
The victim has 19 stab wounds. Some are deep gashes. None are defensive. This man was stabbed in the back over and over again.
In homicide investigations where a knife is used, you expect to see defensive wounds on victims, in that it's a very violent way of dying. It's a very violent attack. We believe he was taken by surprise, and in that he may have known his attacker.
Wark receives a call from a Montreal woman answering the message he left. Her name is Susie Paquette. The body found in the parking lot matches the description of her boyfriend, Luc Gagné. Wark asks Susie to come to Toronto to identify the victim.
Everyone acts different. You never know what type of situation it's going to be. With this young lady, when she observed her boyfriend, she became very emotional, and to the point where she wanted to touch him and hold him.
Susie agrees to meet with Detective Wark for an interview. Wark flies to Montreal to meet her. Susie tells him she's been living with Luc for just over 2 years. They were in love and living the good life together. They threw the best parties in Montreal. But Susie reveals that Luke supported his party habit by dealing drugs. Only the soft kind, hash and grass. He was never in trouble with police. The last time she saw Luke was on June 5th. He was heading for Toronto on business with his friend David Marshall. Nothing out of the ordinary. Wark runs a routine check on Gagné and Marshall with the Montreal police. Gagné's record is clean, just as his girlfriend said. Marshall is another story. He's well known to authorities as a major cocaine dealer. A few years ago, he was convicted for possession and is currently out on parole. Wark asks Montreal police to put Marshall under surveillance. He wants to learn about Marshall's world before he approaches him. Marshall is observed buying a new cell phone. He then leaves the Montreal area.
He was followed across the 401 through Toronto and then stopped at a service area west of Toronto where he met with two males, and they were observed to have a lengthy conversation near Mr. Marshall's vehicle.
Wark gets his first close look at Marshall and the company he keeps.
They were known drug dealers, and they were also on parole, and we believed still involved in illegal activity.
Wark realizes it's going to be a much tougher investigation than he thought. If Gagné was connected to this world, it's not just about selling a little hash to friends. This is a treacherous world, ruled by an unbreakable code of silence. Three weeks after the murder of Luke Gagné, Detective Wark's investigation is grinding to a halt. Marshall has been under steady surveillance, but none of his moves have given them any leads. Detective Wark and his partner, Jeff McGuire, decide that the time has come to approach David Marshall. The trouble is, he's a hard man to pin down.
We were aware of where his girlfriend was working. It was a hair salon in one of the suburbs. And as a result, we attended there, hoping to get in touch with David Marshall.
Police tell Marshall's girlfriend about the brutal slaying of Gagné. She seems shocked and frightened by the news. When the police question her, she says she knows nothing.
She did a pretty good job of doing what the wife in the bad crime movies are supposed to do. She didn't say too much to the police, but left it all on David's shoulders.
Police now know quite a bit about Marshall, and he's not at all what they expected. He comes from a wealthy family, studied at expensive private schools. Somehow, early in his life, he took a bad turn, got heavily involved in gambling and drugs. Police start by asking Marshall where he was on the night of Gagné's murder. Marshall says he was with Gagné earlier that day. He took him to a meeting. Then he let Gagné borrow his Jeep. Marshall stayed in Montreal while his friend drove to Toronto. Wark wants to know where the Jeep is. He needs to find out if Marshall's Jeep is the one which left the distinctive tire print at the crime scene. Marshall says sure, but he wants to consult with his lawyer.
It became sort of a game in that I would call Mr. Marshall. And I would tell him, I want the Jeep, and we need to have the Jeep. You said you'd give it. And he'd say, okay, I'll get back to you. He would hang up, and then 5 minutes later, his lawyer would call me and tell me that the Jeep is not available at this time. It would be soon, but not available.
Wark goes back to Gagné's girlfriend. If Gagné and Marshall were such good buddies, could Gagné's drug dealings have gone beyond soft drugs? Susie admits that her boyfriend began to sell cocaine when he became friends with Marshall. He just dabbled in it at first. Then he and Marshall became partners. That moved him into a whole new world. Eager to prove himself, Luke began pouring cash into Marshall's cocaine deals. The money rolled in, but Susie hated the arrangement. Now police have a new picture of the victim's relationship with David Marshall. But the game with the Jeep keeps going on. Finally, police obtain a search warrant for Marshall's Montreal garage. Marshall explains that the Jeep is away, being photographed on the advice of his lawyer. It'll be turned over to police soon. But McGuire notices something.
And there were some tire impressions on the driveway or inside the garage that looked similar to the tires that we had seen at the crime scene.
Under further questioning, Marshall admits he drove to Toronto with Gagne. But he's been holding that back for a good reason. He was terrified.
And he immediately started to tell me that I had no idea who I was dealing with, that these people were dangerous, and that he feared for his life.
Marshall's new story is that he and Gagne had dinner together in Toronto. That night, Gagne borrowed Marshall's Jeep and went off to complete a coke deal on his own. Marshall had to fly back to Montreal. A few days later, the Jeep showed up at his house. But he has no idea who drove it back. Since then, Marshall has had a personal taste of how vicious the drug world can be.
He said that he had been abducted since the victim's death, and he had been, in his word, tenderized. Which I asked him about that, and he said that he had been beaten for 24 hours before released.
Marshall's explanations are plausible, but Warrick and McGuire need to check out his story. They need to retrace Marshall's each and every move that night. The best way to track him: obtain search warrants to access his cell phone records.
Cellular telephone companies provided me with all kinds of new phone numbers. Every phone number that dialed into or out of David Marshall's cell phone now became another small piece of evidence, if you will, that had to be examined.
Each phone call Marshall made that night is triangulated to give detectives the precise location the call was made from.
We could place him at the time in Toronto, around the time of the murder, and then the next early morning hours of June 6th, returning again across the 401 back to Montreal.
Marshall had lied to them again. The cell phone records prove that he didn't fly back to Montreal, he drove. But was he in the missing black Jeep? Finally, police get a break.
A Montreal investigator from the homicide squad that was working with us got an anonymous call telling him that the Jeep was at a mall, in the parking lot of a mall in South Montreal.
Warrick has it transported to the Forensic Sciences Center in Toronto. Although the Jeep looks clean, an ident officer takes samples, hoping to detect minute traces of blood. But what is of most interest to the police are the tires. Although tires look very similar, each and every one has a unique identity. Roy Gilbert is an expert in the forensic identification of tire marks.
There's many characteristics that are designed and actually built in, or class characteristics the tire has. And the element shape is one of them. The number of ribs in the tire is another. The siping detail is another. And these sipes are tiny little cuts made into the actual elements themselves.
Sipes, which allow the tire to better grasp the pavement, are laid out in a very specific pattern. Using an inking process, Gilbert gets an impression of the black Jeep's tire. He compares that impression with an acetate of the tire print left in the parking lot. It's a match. But Gilbert is looking for something more conclusive, and finds it. A unique tire detail that registered on Gagne's shoe.
There was a sipe detail that was visible on the edge of the shoe. And this sipe detail had two tiny little tears. It was a small piece of rubber that had been actually cut out, and it was just flapping on the face of this tire. This reproduced on the shoe. Very unique thing to have occurred. That was the best impression you could possibly get, is to have that tire run over the shoe at that location.
The swabs of the steering wheel turn out to have tiny specks of blood on them, just enough for a DNA profile. The results come in. The blood in the car matches the DNA of the victim. Police now have Gagne's blood in the Jeep and Marshall's Jeep at the scene. Although they strongly suspect that David Marshall is the killer, they have nothing to connect him personally to the murder. Police believe that David Marshall murdered Luc Gagne, but they have no proof. So Detective McGuire continues searching Marshall's phone records, hoping to trace the people he spoke with around the time of the murder. But getting search warrants for hundreds of phone calls is a tedious process.
At one point, I just got a little tired of doing search warrants, so I picked the phone up and I phoned this number direct, and a young lady answered the phone.
The young woman is from Montreal. Yes, she knows David Marshall. When did she last see him? She remembers quite well. It was very early one morning at the beginning of June.
She was awoken in her house. She had some dogs, and the dogs were barking. She went downstairs to a garage, and there were two people there cleaning out a Jeep.
One was her boyfriend. The other was his ex-cellmate, David Marshall. But when police ask the woman if she's willing to give them a written statement, she backs off and refuses.
Her comment was something like, I'm not going to change my mind. You can call me in 3 days, 3 years, or 30 years. I am never telling you anything.
Police are closing in on Marshall, but they still don't have a motive. Why would he stab his friend to death? Once more, Wark turns to Susie for help. All she can offer is that Marshall may have resented Luke's growing success. A few months ago, Marshall was jailed briefly for parole violation. Luke took the opportunity to expand his territory. By the time Marshall got out, Luke had become the big player. It seemed Marshall accepted the shift in power. He even set up a big cocaine deal for them in Toronto. Police can now see a possible motive, revenge. But they need concrete evidence.
We still don't have any witness. We don't have anybody that's even put David Marshall in Toronto. And we started talking about what would he have on his body that he might have had with him that day. Well, how about his cell phone? He said, you guys, every time you meet him, cell phone's on his belt, and it's always ringing, and he's always talking.
They know that less than 72 hours after the murder, Marshall bought a new cell phone. Where's his old one? They obtain a search warrant for Marshall's house, hoping he hasn't thrown it away. They find it hidden in his bedroom. The phone looks clean on the outside, but looks can be deceiving. They send it to forensics for testing.
Sure enough, the biologist at the Center for Forensic Science completely dismantled the phone and was able also to identify the victim's blood all over the cell phone, buried in underneath the buttons and in the hinge, certainly not visible to the naked eye.
With this final piece of evidence, police decide to make their move. On September 29th, 5 months after Gagne's murder, Marshall is arrested and charged with first-degree murder. He continues to claim he's innocent. Police have no eyewitness, no murder weapon. Their evidence is all circumstantial. But Wark and McGuire feel they can present a convincing case in court. They believe that from the moment Gagne took over Marshall's territory, Marshall began plotting his revenge. He played on Gagne's weakness, his greed. The cocaine deal of June 5th was a setup. All along, he was luring Gagne to his death. Marshall wined and dined Gagné that night in a Toronto bar, softening him up for the double cross. But Gagné didn't leave the bar alone. Marshall went with him. He drove to a deserted parking lot and took his revenge. Marshall drove away, unaware he had left his signature behind. The tire print on Gagné's shoe found in the very first hour of the investigation. With Gagné out of the picture, Marshall was back in charge. Marshall is found guilty of first-degree murder. He is sentenced to life in prison. Gagné was naive to think that he could move into Marshall's territory without paying the ultimate price. Revenge knows no mercy. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case. The names of the victims are fictitious. The names of the convicted are real.